Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Winter. An academic...
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year. It's 2017. We used to do that thing at the beginning where we would ask, like, a short question, and then we would never did it in a short fashion. Let me introduce Karen first.
Okay.
An academic Karen Thompson.
Hello.
Hello, Karen
Hey,
Thompson.
Everybody.
Karen, how did you ring in 2017?
We had a lovely dinner with friends at someone's home, and then we went party hopping.
You and the new official missus.
Yeah, me and the missus. But we had, like, 7 million potential plans and ended up deciding on three, and by the end of the night, the missus, like, we got to a club, and the missus was just like, I'm kissing you at midnight, and I'm going to go home.
Yeah.
Well, that's the trouble.
It's the
trouble with New Year's as a night is that there is, like, this one signature event, and if you go to a party and you're not there for that point in time, it's like you weren't really there. Like,
it is
hard to party hop. Winter, what did you do?
My boyfriend and I went to Palm Springs and stayed at the Saguaro. And we went to dinner early that night, and then we were thinking about going to the party, but you know, it was raining torrentially that night.
Yeah.
Which completely, I lost all interest in doing anything outside. So we literally went back to the hotel and watched Mariah. Yeah.
Let's take this brief moment and say it is hard to see a diva transition to this new phase, which all of our divas do to some extent, of like, no longer the creature she once was.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, in many ways, it was sad to see that happen to Mariah, but it's also kind of, to me, exciting in the ways that it opens up this new persona for her. Like, she can now be...
It's the arc of divadom. I mean, think about, like, where the places Judy Garland took us.
Right.
Yeah. She needs to just sort of dive into it instead of like, dancing, like, coquettishly around it. She needs to just sequin herself up and zip up and dive.
Yes. I spent the week between Christmas and New Year's taking my niece on a trip down California where I, even though she's not old enough to look at colleges yet, I made her walk through empty colleges and talk to her about going to college because it's not something that happens in our family that much.
Amazing.
And that's wonderful.
But also Universal Studios and Disneyland, and it meant that I rang in the new year, like, at the end of the Matterhorn. The Matterhorn, like, was over at 8 because I could not make her understand, like, you're not going to want to be, like, she kept just wanting to go into short lines because, no, like, everybody was in the middle of Disneyland waiting.
Right.
Who are these weird people having a sober New Year's? But, like,
you can't drink inside of Disneyland?
You have to go
to Downtown Disney to drink.
Yeah.
And the ESPN zone too, which is sad.
But she did finally, like, once the fireworks happened, she was like, oh yes, there was a reason we did need to be doing this outside with the other people.
Okay.
So it was charming. All right, coming up on this week's show, it is a new year, so we're all going to talk about our pop culture resolutions. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what our entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Thompson, what are you all about this week?
Well, mine is a blast from the past because my adolescent nightmare happened on Christmas and my forever boyfriend, George Michael, died. And I found out while I was frying lumpia and guests came over for a party. In any case, I was moved to exhume my saxophone from the attic room. And at some point that night, I played the sax riff from Careless Whisper over and over again on my saxophone while people sat rapt in attention.
So what did George Michael mean to a young Karen Thompson?
George Michael was a very exciting figure to me because he was at once incredibly sexy and masculine, but in a way also really super manscaped. And there was something about his manicured masculinity that was really appealing to me. And I think that also one of the things that I like to do was his vocal range was pretty close to my own.
Oh.
And so I could sing along to the music and I could imagine myself both being him, but being also the object of his desire. Right. And so I think that so for George Michael to me was like one of my first kind of self-unaware inklings of tingly proto-queer feeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, throughout his career, that's been the case. my All About in tribute to George is actually the moment where he emerged as someone whose vocal talent we really recognized. And that's that was kind of his signature. And he wasn't just a kind of pop boy toy. And that's when he sang Elton John's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. Go down, come down. I cannot think of the proper phrase.
Come down.
Come down, excuse me.
Either way, it's Randy.
Live Aid 1985, when he takes the stage at Wembley Stadium. It's also the first time he debuts that look with the close cropped beard and the leather jacket, like kind of presaging the Faith era.
No more of your darkness. All my pictures seem to fade to black and white. I'm growing tired.
Like 1.9 billion people watched that, right? And also, just rewatching that video, I invite all of you out there listening to take a look at it. It's still on YouTube. Elton John just looks so thrilled that he's, you know, he's in deep mentorship mode, and he's just like stoked to hear George take this song to another place. And obviously he did. The song charted from that live performance, and then they re-recorded it again also in Wembley Stadium in 1991, and it became a big hit on the Duets album.
I deeply believe that we were going to get this George Michael late career shares believe kind of like like rising from the ashes. And there is also the thing of like, it is so hard for so many of these performers who were gay at a transitional time. And, and this is kind of a cool opportunity for them to just get to be themselves and not have to worry about anything. And do you feel like what happened with George Michael at the bathroom in Beverly Hills made him uncomfortable being in the public eye, or was he doing stuff that I wasn't aware of?
I think that actually, you know, and I've visited that bathroom multiple times. I even took a photo coming out of the bathroom and lurking around. My missus took a photo of me doing that before George died, of course. That's how deeply I was connected to him. But I actually don't think so. I think that when he was brought out, it was just sort of, well, oh, well, whatever. You know, I think that. I think that he also, you know, when he recorded Outside, it was a parody of that whole scene. He thematized it in his music. And as he was moving into, like, you know, Freedom 90, as he was moving into even I Want Your Sex, one of the things that he was doing was experimenting with a kind of broad-based desire and sexual, a free-flowing, free-form, I mean, orgiastic.
The work he does with Too Funky and the video of Too Funky to talk all about sex without necessarily involving his own sex has always fascinated me. Winter, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about, obviously, Carrie Fisher left us way too soon. She had so much more work to do. I mean, she just had so much more work to do. And my relationship with Carrie Fisher as a fan is nothing at all involved with the Star Wars. As we know, I have a very conflicted relationship with Star Wars. And it's much more with the work she did post-Star Wars.
So when did you meet Carrie Fisher? When did she become something to you?
I think that the essence of her being Princess Leia was out there.
Yeah.
That definitely was important because I know it was important to a lot of people. But then I saw her do stuff outside of that role and I was like, she needs to be around more because she's not doing enough stuff. She's so complicated. I think that the essence of her is really Postcards from the Edge, even though she was in When Harry Met Sally and she was in Drop Dead Fred. But there were the stories that spilled out from Postcards from the Edge.
Well, I mean, the fact that, like, we all watched Postcards from the Edge.
Yeah.
And then we saw, like, her having a party and her mom, throwing her dress up. And then
it twirled up.
Up. And then we all saw Debbie Reynolds die a day after Carrie Fisher. And it was like, even in death, her mother's upstaging her.
But the thing is that that's where I related to her most. I related to her, one, because I love this business and I'm obsessed with people who have these legacies in this business that's complicated, and they came from a time that was complicated where you weren't really supposed to talk about your complicated issues being, because you're supposed to be, you know.
I'm street smart. Unfortunately, okay. The street was Rodeo Drive.
Exactly.
Like, it's the best line.
Yeah, it's the best line. And she just really, God, there's just, and the script doctoring, and the reason she stopped script doctoring, because it was just becoming a game where she didn't feel like playing that game anymore. And
in what way?
She didn't feel like playing, she said, I'm just sort of paraphrasing what she said, but she's like, look, you know, I would come in, they would ask me to come in, and they would pay me up front to touch up a script and make it better. And then it became a situation where they wanted me to go in and pitch people, and then they take my idea, and then I don't have the idea. They give it to some young kid and pay them less. I don't want to play that game anymore, and I don't have to. The luxury of not having to do that. She's so important that when I met Brian Lord, I was more enthralled by the fact that Brian Lord had a child with her and was not
the gay guy who
married
her,
yeah. And not the partner of CAA, of a place that I always thought I would one day work when I worked for their competition. So there was that, and there was also just being bold about her mental illness, which so many people are not, and talking about it. Her Twitter feed is a fascinating thing to behold, because she's like one of the few people allowed online, on Twitter specifically, to be going through her high and low spells and exist in whatever, she's BP1 or BP2, exist in that. And everybody was just like, oh, Carrie. And I think about, you can only allow that to happen with someone who has such a storied, fabric-y, thick, legendary birth, upbringing, history.
My All About is also Carrie Fisher. Yeah. And to me, it really is her line that, like, she could keep it together enough to do a
yes.
day of work.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for me, as somebody who, like, started out as a little boy who loved Star Wars and then saw When Harry Met Sally and was like, oh, Princess Leia, like, that glamorous creature from that movie I like is here. And it gave me an in to these, like, more adult movies. But they are performances like Marie and When Harry Met Sally, who perfectly counter, like, she and Bruno Kirby make that movie possible.
Yeah.
By being so
gone.
So realistic.
Yeah, Bruno Kirby passed away a few years ago.
I didn't know. But, like, they provide such ballast to that movie, and, you know, not having the golden lightness of Meg Ryan in a relationship, but still making you love it. Drop Dead Fred and Soap Dish, we must consider together.
Thank you.
As her playing, like, I think it's her opening line yes. in Soap Dish is, I'm Betsy Faye Sharon and I'm a bitch. And it's like, it's this negligible character who she manages to provide with so much personality and drama and dynamic. And it is the fact that she is just an unrelenting creature. And let us speak of the Blues Brothers. And,
yes.
And the thing about the Blues Brothers is realizing, like, oh, she had been dating John Belushi. Like, that her biography was always streaming in through anything she did. I remember how I learned about Liz Taylor, Eddie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds was her appearing on Letterman and just making a shitty comment about Liz Taylor.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer Aniston.
The Angelina Jolie of that situation.
Yeah.
No, her saying, I'm not going to buy the perfume. And it was like, it was such beautifully crafted lines and such ownership of everything that she did. But, like, I just loved the Carrie Fisherness of when Albert Brooks was making Mother.
Yes.
They wanted to make a parody of Mrs. Robinson. And she was able to be like, I'll just talk to, like, I was married to Paul for a week. I'll just figure this out.
Yeah.
And I already have a jam, but, like, the one and one half wandering Jews in Heart and Bone from Paul Simon. But just the way that this personality, it both inhabited so many iconic characters and surpassed them.
Yeah.
Like, you're either Kim Kardashian, who can only be yourself, or Meryl Streep, who is able to inhabit amazing roles. But Carrie Fisher was always Carrie Fisher, but that never hurt her roles.
I was just going to say her star text was definitely always, like, kind of messiness of her star text was always part of her roles in particular, I'm thinking of Rosemary in 30 Rock as well, right? The kind of hot mess, but who is like captivating and charismatic.
Yeah. She never needed to be a lead role, even though she was like this huge legendary figure. And I feel like you never saw stories in trades like Carrie Fisher is vying for something else. She knew her.
But it always left you hungry.
It always left you hungry.
And every time I saw her, like in Drop Dead Fred, which is like, it's so magical that in this Phoebe Cates vehicle, you're getting...
Wasn't Princess Caribou, but okay.
but you're getting full-on Carrie Fisher. Like, she would show up and stuff, and you would be like, why on earth is she doing this?
Exactly.
But it was magical.
Just sort of like those 30 seconds that whatever Brando was paid $30 million for or something like that for Superman, or $1 million a second or something.
Oh, my God.
But Carrie Fisher had that same kind of ability to steal the scene, but not to do it in any way that was crass, but that was just like where you know, it's like this belongs to her.
Yeah.
Right?
And we're going to get to Debbie Reynolds in my jam, but do we want to talk for a minute about Debbie Reynolds?
We have to. I feel like we can't talk about her seed without talking about the vessel in which the seed came from.
Absolutely. To me, Debbie Reynolds is always Miss Burbank hoofing it in Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And everything else that she did...
Discovered in high school in Hollywood, right?
But it was that kind of, she was never a grand diva. Mm-hmm. She was the sweet girl next door who you wanted to love, but always working and finding ways of making herself relevant.
Yeah.
Will and Grace, Mother, mm-hmm. like that she was, and that she had Carrie as this strange partner to find ways of being relevant into the 21st century. Carrie writing These Old Broads for her and...
Elizabeth.
Liz Taylor was in that, right?
And Shirley MacLaine, I think, too.
Was it
Liza Minnelli?
Joan Collins?
Maybe Joan Collins. Yes.
Point is, like, Debbie Reynolds was never the world's grand actress. She was nominated for an Academy Award for Unsinkable Molly Brown.
She had number one hit song.
Tammy?
Tammy?
Yeah. Oh, wonder. Those Tammy movies, they came on TV.
Tammy!
And they are fucking adorable.
Yes! Oh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, it's funny because... My mom is a year older than Carrie Fisher. My grandmother was a year younger than Debbie Reynolds.
Uh-huh.
And so I've seen and witnessed this particular kind of dynamic because they were also show people, right?
Yeah.
And so there's something about them and their relationship and all of its fraughtness that felt very familiar and close to me personally. But I mean, also just having a text like Postcards from the Edge to work with, or even something like Wishful Drinking, right? To kind of illuminate the deep care, fucked upness, and still kind of matriarchal competition that was going on is, you know, it's amazing that we have such an archive of that through both of them.
The way that women are able to both care about each other and have hostility within that caring, the relationships of sisters and mothers and daughters fascinate me.
It is fascinating.
And I don't understand them.
Well, I just want to say Singing in the Rain is one of those movies that my grandmother would put on Christmas morning.
Oh, yeah.
And we would watch and we would sit there and watch it. And she learning that she had to study, sing and dance and act for this role. And she was in training for like 2 to 3 months just to get everything right. She has Beyonce-esque. I mean, Beyonce would have to credit Debbie Reynolds, but it's just the energy to exude this amount of passion for a role.
Well, no, what you can't teach, what you can't train 3 months for, being goddamn Sunshine.
Yes,
you can't.
She is Sunshine.
She's fucking Sunshine.
It's true. Throughout that entire movie.
All right, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about our pop culture resolutions after this.
Okay.
The great questions of your life.
The great questions of your life.
Should you put ketchup on a hot dog?
Put ketchup on a hot dog.
Toilet paper over or under?
Toilet paper.
Star Wars?
Star Wars.
Or Star Trek?
Or Star Trek.
Fear not, my friends.
Fear not,
Mark
my
and
friends.
Hal always reach the definitive answer. Simply listen to We Got This with Mark and Hal every Tuesday at 9 p.m. Pacific on Maximum Fun.
Fine.
We got this. Your better self is right around the corner. Namaste.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell
and Karen Tongson.
And it is a brand new year, and we are taking on a brand new slate of popular culture. And we wanted to talk about the ways that we were going to change and evolve the pop culture we consume. What are our pop culture resolutions? Winter Mitchell, what's one of your pop culture resolutions?
I would love less reality TV based on excess. I think we're getting to a point in the world where people just don't give a shit about your excess. I think we've been sliding towards there, but we're really now in the thick of it. I also would love to see...
Well, no, before you pass that on, one of my resolutions is to watch all of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
So to absorb the excess, to catch up to it.
Because there are...
There's
a bunch of female-targeted reality TV that people always assume that I will participate in, and I don't a lot of it. And
this is your personal resolution?
This is my personal resolution. Okay, okay. I mean, I already started it, but it is one of those things that I'm committed to finishing. And I just wanted to have at least one of the mythoses that... that I could speak of with authority. And I have to tell you, it is... And the reason I wanted to go after Beverly Hills was because that is the place where they are legitimately rich, where it does feel like there are legitimate consequences.
You're really picking the wrong one.
And it is beautiful to watch.
But
it is wonderful.
You're picking the wrong city.
Why?
You're picking the wrong city.
Which one would it be?
Atlanta? No, I didn't even watch this business.
I was a deep Atlanta watcher for like 3 years at least.
I'm between New York and OC because they've been
the original OC.
Yeah, the OC is the original, and they've been together. Like, there's real stakes there.
For me, it feels like they're
financial stakes. Like, these people are hanging on by that just the thread.
That's not what I want to see. What I want to like, I like that they're training wheels on Beverly Hills.
I like the stress. I like the thirst of it. Watching the thirst is something
like
I can grab on.
OC feels like chthonic and vast, and like I could never completely understand what's going on because it's just been too long of a soap opera. Beverly Hills, it is close to my world. I know where Pump is. And I like that so many of those ladies do have like a real reason that they are famous. And I wanted to, like, this is the world we live in.
Sure.
I do think you owe it to yourself to learn about it, you know?
And Boy George is coming on the show. Is that correct?
Oh, really?
No.
I just saw an ad.
I'm thinking about Celebrity Apprentice.
No, I think that, you know, I just saw an ad. There's a new housewife in town, and there's Boy George shows up.
I'm grossly out of date.
You're still watching, like, season three or four.
I'm finishing season two.
Oh, wow.
There was just an extremely important white party.
Oh, the white party.
Gosh.
Yes.
You're way back in the day.
Yes. That is my resolution, to be able to, and also just like the thing of, you need things that can be go-tos to talk to certain demographics of people about. Mm-hmm. Like in the way that, like, I always need to have some video game awareness so that if I am with a straight guy at a party, I can talk about something. And like, Basic Girls and I can have a nice conversation when I'm like, I'm just learning about Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
But So the antithesis of that is that I don't want to continue to have these conversations on the outside because it's not – my brain has turned the mush. Mm-hmm. The internet has made my brain mush. So has television. So I already cut down television. I already cut down on my cable diet, and I really just want to read. I don't want to really spend a ton of time in front of – media. I mean, Real Housewives is a franchise, the only one I can probably bear, but like,
what about Storage Wars though? What do we do with something like that?
No, because it's not going to feed me anything. Like, I'm not going to be like really skilled at going into storage units. Like, I want to be really skilled at like talking about, you know, Trump in a really smart way.
I think one of the things that we have lost is reductive TV. We have all of this TV that is essentially movies, that are things that need you to be invested in watching them. And it is the place of, I mean, I don't think Storage Wars is great. I wish there were light comedies. I wish that there were more things like Kimmy Schmidt or whatever where you can watch and have a good time. But I do feel like these things occupy a niche that isn't being filled by anything better. Karen, what are you resolving?
Well, I realize rather disturbingly that I get all my news from social media platforms.
Yeah.
And that I actually haven't, you know, I don't have a morning ritual anymore where I'd check the paper or even the website of a newspaper, but I would see, you know, what my feed was telling me.
Yeah.
And I think that my biggest New Year's resolution is to quit getting news from these platforms and to actually, like, explore other venues and other places, and revisiting print culture to a certain extent, or revisiting, you know, like, looking at the Washington Post in the morning and the LA Times.
Yeah.
Versus just assuming that my entire social media community is going to have curated all the material for me that I need to know
exactly.
about. Exactly. And or that I have to participate in this curatorial enterprise for others, you know?
Well, what's interesting about it is that it is Donald Trump's, well, people are saying, writ large.
Yeah.
Like, it is us sort of, like, taking cacophonous voices to be or not even cacophonous voices. One voice that gives you an excuse to believe something mm-hmm. is enough. And it is horrifying because we've all done it.
Yeah. Well, and also I realize my ability to find things is atrophying, right? So my ability to find things on my own is atrophying, and I'm relying more and more on various forms of mediation, people mediating that experience for me. And so I'm going to revisit sites of pleasure for myself and just be like, okay, I'm going to make it a point to go directly to this thing that I'm curious yeah. about, whether or not I want to read something on Slate or Jezebel or Reductress, or if I want to, you know, pick, like, I also, like, no more HuffPo. It's just, like, gotten out of control because it's
got
every other
Huffington
yeah,
Post.
It's just, like, every other piece is somebody, like, bitching and moralizing at someone else about how they're consuming pop culture wrongly, or, you know, or that you're not woke enough to, like, appreciate this. And
yeah.
I'm like, ugh, that's exhausting. That's the lowest form of criticism, if you can call it that. I want to revisit the art of criticism. Criticism performed artfully by
like
critics.
Like Siskel and Ebert? Yeah. Like, I miss Siskel and Ebert. I miss a simple, like, I didn't like it. I'm, you know, the general population. I represent them.
People
and
who
it's a thumbs
know
down.
Something, actually know something
yes,
about what they're talking about.
But we don't
about.
Know who knows anything anymore.
Okay. I would like to bring up another one of my pop culture resolutions. I need to work harder to seek out female film critics, queer film critics, and film critics of color. I realize that for too long I have been relying on
The A.O. Scotts of the world.
The A.O. Scotts of the world. And A.A. Dowd of the A.V. Club. And I always get pissed off. Like, I always read them and I'm like, fuck you, dude. You don't understand what a rom-com is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I... That pissed offedness needs to go somewhere and evolve. And I miss so much when Lindy West was still doing film criticism.
She's no longer on Twitter, which we've also lost another avenue for her voice.
Yeah, but I need to... So if you guys have any suggestions for, like, if your local paper has, like, a good film critic, even if it is a straight guy, but just give me more film critics who I should be going to, because
Dana Stevens.
Dana's amazing.
Yeah.
Shout out to at High Sign.
Yeah.
Or the High Sign. But I love the process of reading a review after I have seen a movie, and I want people I can be electrified by.
There's no, the problem is that we let headlines seduce us, and then we get in bed with them, and then we try to walk away from them in the morning, and then we call them up for booty calls. And we need to just straight up block people that are not, whose voices don't fucking matter. There's a lot of there's too many people talking, and there's not enough substance, and we're allowing the internet to control that, and we're giving power to voices that don't actually need to be empowered. The one thing that I love that has been done lately is that we let, you know, Trump wins. He's out there. He's tweeting up a fucking storm. But the left were so busy trying to fight him that they weren't really getting in those conversations with him while he was running and while he was in the course.
We never got in conversations.
Now we're in conversations, yeah. And it's becoming like an industry itself of telling, being the first person to tell him, you're a fucking clown and here's why I think
like
so.
We got seduced by headlines, and that was the problem. Would you like to give us another resolution? Why don't I give one of mine? I'm going to stop clicking through listicles.
What is it, 2012?
Hey, I love, that I love facts. Oh God, I love facts. And listicles are just Lucy with a football. Like, it never is as good as you want. It's the same things you always want. All right, Leonard, do you have one for us?
Pop culture resolution from moi?
Yes.
I'm actually going to stop buying samples of books on, not buying, but like downloading samples of books on iBooks.
Yeah.
And actually start reading them. I'm in the process of figuring out my own writing process, but like I'm constantly just like downloading samples. And then what happens is if you have to reboot or change your iPad or whatever you're going to do, back it up and restart it, you lose all your samples, so you don't remember what you were going to actually buy. The problem is I already have 2,500 books in my house, and I would say like 100 of them I have not actually read. So maybe 300. But I actually haven't opened at all. And I need to start reading books more often. I need to read more often. I need to be away from the television. The other thing, too, is that I really want to – I haven't finished a game in probably 10 years, and I'm really close to finishing Uncharted 4, and I want to finish the game.
That's a great resolution.
I just want to finish a fucking game. You pay $60 for this shit. And you get the ability to free world around it. And I need to
rescue the princess.
Yes. And I just want to, like, yeah, I need to go save the princess. And I also need to stop talking to the 10-year-olds on there as if I'm okay with the way that they speak to me and in general.
Karen, give us a resolution.
Okay. So, well, when you guys were talking about games, I actually, you know, this isn't one of my official ones that I was going to bring in, but I do want to start playing live poker again. And that's something that I used to do. Uh-huh. And I know, and yes, it's 2008 all over again.
No, it isn't.
But that's another thing that I'd like to do, is because I always really appreciated the interaction of that. Because it's social and it's entertaining. But it's, you know, it's something where you don't have to engage people too much, but you just really engage their strategy. So that's one thing. A real more pop culture oriented thing, though, is that I want to, kind of the opposite of you, Winter, because like I have to do books for a living, like write books, read books, teach books. And so I want to subscribe to more magazines. And particularly, I re-upped, after many years, my Entertainment Weekly subscription.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I didn't have time to read them anymore because I'm so busy teaching.
I know, but that strange fossil with its letter grades.
Yeah, right?
Like 10 pages. You don't need it.
Well, no, but I mean, I actually always enjoyed. I mean, I haven't seen it in a little while. I saw a recent, you know, I like the fall TV preview, et cetera. And I do think that there's some, you know, good criticism in there and some kind of witty turns of phrase. Yeah. So I'm going to be visiting. And also The Hollywood Reporter.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh.
And THR. Because I think that, I think it's just like behooves me, instead of reading the kind of secondhand diluted account of what the industry is doing in different parts of the LA Times, to just get The Hollywood Reporter.
Karen, that's so fascinating to me that you, as an academic, and it's not like you're in the film school or something like that, like that you, in this horrible, horrible, fetid town, would be interested in taking The Hollywood Reporter. Take me through this process.
Well, I mean, you know, I write so much about media and popular culture and film and TV and popular music. And so I have to do that research anyway.
Right.
And sometimes I have to do it belatedly, and I have to track down this information. Like when I'm writing my book about, you know, norm porn TV shows, I have to go back to this industry history. And so,
but
I
also,
like, kind of,
why,
you know,
not recognize names when you're at Soho House? Why not have things to talk about at Christmas parties?
Well, I mean, and I am surrounded by my world, though my professional world is largely academic, most of my social world is very much embedded in the industry.
Yeah. Right?
So, and I think that part of what it's done is it's helped me to kind of get a better sense of the landscape, behind the scenes stuff. And so, yeah, it works for my work as well as for my social worlds. And I want to be informed about who's paying who to do this.
Yeah.
And because I think it makes a difference. And the more we know that kind of information about our entertainment, the better critics and thinkers will be about this work.
Well,
yes, I agree.
I mean, it's very funny that we got good at understanding actors and writers and directors and stuff, and being able to have more of a conversation about who execs are and how they impact stuff that gets made is very interesting to me. All right, my next resolution is I am going to read more of the like nonfiction, personal essay, comedy-ish books that, like, I'm currently working on a book. I need to read more of these books because I need to see what other people are doing, but they are so hard for me to read, and particularly I have been trying to work through a book of Chuck Klosterman essays, and the man, this is very similar. This is like similar but opposite to the thing I was saying about film criticism of I just start reading one of the essays and I'm like, stop, and I put it down, and I need to release some of the hostility I have towards a straight white guy taking his own perspective as being the most important thing on the planet. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because I'm a grown up and I'm 41 years old and I don't get to just dismiss them anymore because there's so much good writing in there. And also in my anger are good, compelling, and interesting thoughts. And so just not engaging is not the answer. The answer is like engaging and thinking about it. And there's also so much stuff that is coming from other kinds of people. So many books by my friends or people who I really like. Like my friend Jamie Lee just wrote a book called Ridiculous that is about her planning her wedding. And she's one of the funniest people I've ever met. And I for such a long time, avoided that world because it was so thick with people I knew and what they were doing. And I just kind of need to jump in.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of amazing creative nonfiction going on.
Yeah.
In different styles and genres. My favorite, I think that I've mentioned this on the show before, is Candace Bergen's Knock Wood. Have you ever read that book before?
No.
And she did not do it with a ghostwriter. She wrote it herself.
Is it a memoir?
It's a memoir. And in fact, my missus is giving a talk about it at the Modern Language Association in Philadelphia. In any case, it is so good.
What is Rachel's shtick particularly?
I'm talking about Candace Bergen's book, Knock Wood.
No, I'm sorry. You said your lady. Her name is Sarah.
Oh, her name is Sarah. Is you're one of those Jewess?
I'm sorry.
Names of a Jewess.
They all look alike to me.
Sarah Rebecca Kessler.
I mean,
okay.
If I had kept going, I would have gotten there eventually.
Yeah, in any
but
case.
But what is Sarah's shtick particularly?
Sarah writes about ventriloquism.
Okay.
So, ventriloquism and media. So, like, real ventriloquists, but also how we use the metaphor and, like, media. This talk in particular is about autobiographies that focus on, like, kind of twisted ventriloquial family autobiographies where there's somebody who's, like, Charlie Bergen, right? You know, obviously. Like Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, see?
Yeah.
And like the kind of sibling rivalry between Candy and the puppet.
A truly juicy actress memoir is like the best thing on the planet. Yeah. Melina Mercouri's I Was Born Greek is one of the best books I've ever read because, I mean, it's her fucking and fighting with her husband, but at the same time, Greek democracy finding its way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so much too, and all of the kind of you can imagine all the metaphors of woodenness through that, and
yes.
You know, lots of like really sexy parts to it too. So, in any case, I think that would be a good read for you this year.
All right, my two resolutions as it relates to sort of like news and more formal discourse are: A, if I read something in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times, I have to get to the end of the article. I have to read all the way to the end of the article. I do not get
before you share it.
I do not get to. Well, and I just don't get to bounce away. I don't get to say, oh, I've learned enough. I have to read to the end of the article. And then the other thing is I at least once a month, I'm going to consume a thing that is not for me. We have gotten into spaces where we are like, there is the problem of this echo chamber and like reading Hillbilly Elegy, which kind of is for me. I am the child of trash who has done all right for himself. But reading a book that was written by a conservative libertarian about what the like Midwest is like was good for me. Mm-hmm. So why not?
Well, that's always been my ethos, but I do like the idea of radical openness versus high alert at what might be coming. And so let's see where we can take that and, you know, be strong and vigilant.
I watched Celebrity Apprentice.
I did too.
I mean, the worst part is that it's a hell of a show.
It's really interesting.
Doesn't need to be 2 hours. Doesn't need to hand us our next head of state.
2 hours. I was just on the edge of my seat the entire time.
All right. Those are our resolutions. Please share your resolutions on our Facebook page. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
If you love podcasts, comedy, and creativity, and you're looking for some new friends to share them with, why not check out Max FunCon 2017? Max FunCon is a chance to get away from it all, spend a weekend laughing, and return inspired to create amazing things. Join us for Max FunCon in Lake Arrowhead in June, or Max FunCon East in the Poconos in September, and prepare yourself for one of the best weekends of your life. Tickets are on sale now at maxfuncon.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell
and Karen Tongson.
Hey, Winter Mitchell. Every week on this show, we ask ourselves a question. Winter, what's your jam?
My jam is this beautiful rendition of Amy Winehouse's song, Love is a Losing Game by George Michael. And he covered this at Bercy in Paris a few years back. And I read this really sweet story about how, you know, George Michael being as, you know, he's a megastar, and he wasn't out there like some of his contemporaries, like, you know, in that way more recently. But he's definitely, in my mind, one of the massive stars of the 80s that I grew up on. And to hear the fact that he never collaborated with Amy was something that troubled him. And his reasoning was he was too nervous to ask her.
Oh.
And I just think that that is so humble for someone who's so mega and huge. And I also think that this version of that song, which she obviously just painfully, just it's so gutturally amazing how well Amy Winehouse sang this song, but he does it a lot of justice. And Crystal Paschal recommended this in my Twitter feed, and I love her for it. This is Love is a Losing Game.
More than I could stand. Love, it is a losing game. Self-defense, profile.
He's so good at that sort of mournful, almost torchy music. I mean, Kissing a Fool was sort of a preview to that. And you know, he just has that kind of sweet tenor croony voice that is also kind of haunted. That's a beautiful track.
It's why I think Careless Whisper, you know, he never gave any indication, not that he needed to, of what his sexual preference was. Mm-hmm. But when you think about Careless Whisper, he could have been singing to a dude. He could have been singing to a chick. But it's a universal song that everybody could relate to. It didn't have, you know, a lot of men in that era seemed to need to be like, girl, and, you know, add all of that, or boy. And he was really like, he could just sing his ass off.
Yeah.
And Karen Tongson, what's your jam?
So it's striking that Winter also selected a George Michael cover, because my jam this week is Wham's cover, 1984 cover of the Isley Brothers' 1973 hit, If You Were There. Mm. And number one, George Michael obviously is a very facile singer and excellent and can do any cover in any position, which way. But there's something about this particular cover, and I heard this when I was an 11-year-old girl, and it made me swoon. And this particular cover, it kind of sweetens and turns the Isley Brothers a little bit looser, a little more jammy, ballad, basically, or like kind of shuffly ballad song, into a tight, taut 80s pop bobble. And I'm just going to go ahead and start playing it for you right now. George Michael's voice differs considerably from Ronald Isley's, though it's certainly recognizable.
You're the one that makes my day a dream come true. Yet and still you wonder if I think of you. You ought to see how the other girls behave when you're not around. And only then you would know that it's on your finger. If you were there.
And that's right before the chorus, of course. But yeah, which you can kind of hear a little bit in the background now. But George, I think that one of the things about this song, too, is that even though it sounds kind of bubblegum and teeny boppery, there's a certain kind of vocal maturity that he modeled. And I know that I loved singing along to it because there was a way in which George Michael's vocal range was kind of similar to mine. Mm. And in that way, I could project myself into both the singer and the one being sung to. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was kind of what you were saying about Careless Whisper and a kind of this open object of desire.
Yeah.
Is one of the things that like set my bubblegum heart a-bouncing when mm-hmm. I heard this song. And so Wham was really, that album was top to bottom wonderful, and I know every word, every gasp, every sigh in it, and I'm gonna miss George Michael a lot.
Yeah.
This week my jam is as I said earlier, a performance by a young 18-year-old Miss Burbank in 1952. This is my favorite song from Singin' in the Rain.
Now the milkman's on his way. It's too late to say goodnight. So good morning, sunbeams will still smile through. Good morning to you and you and you and you. Good morning, we've gabbed the whole night through. Good morning to you.
Nothing could be grander than to be in Louisiana in the morning.
In the morning, it's great.
As a small child watching it, the cleverness that they were singing good morning because it was so late at night was hilarious to me. That movie, if you haven't watched it recently, you need to rewatch it because it's all fucking good. Every moment, every song, everything is classic throughout the entire thing. But to me, Good Morning was always the hoofiness song. It like there was nothing else going on. It was just them tapping real, real hard. And then also the fact that while Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly are doing this sort of like athletic work, just the fact that she has in this big white collar catches the light and illuminates her face so much more than the two gentlemen. And to me, that's what being a woman like to that's why I like watched movies and were like, women are better. Women have personalities. Women have these faces. They're giving of themselves. They're sharing of themselves. They're not just doing things. They're also letting you participate in the way that they are doing it. And I had, like, as a kid, I had no idea how young she was. I just knew that she was the best and so much fun. And, you know, that movie also isn't respected as, like, a wonderful romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, the very notion that, like, she climbs into that car and starts telling him what's wrong with movie actors. And then a couple of days later, he shows up at a birthday party where she's one of the women who's like...
Jumps out of the cake
and sort of puts her in the most compromised female position
exactly.
possible.
Where like, she has to work and be like, you know...
It's the 50s, so we're not in any way commenting on this or struggling with it. But it's also a well-written script with good performers. So there is this tension between the fact that, like, she's in this very low-status position, but she's so awesome, it doesn't matter, because she is great. And that we forget that movie is all about him championing a woman's voice.
Yeah.
Like, it is all about him saying, she's the talented one, she's the one who deserves to be part of this. Screw Gene Hagen. Not that Gene Hagen isn't amazing. I Ain't People is possibly the best joke that has ever been written. That movie fires on all cylinders at all time. And I think that it is, for me at least, was so iconic that it took me a really long time to realize that it was good and not just that one movie where he sings in the rain.
And I also really hope that people show it to their children.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Have an introduction to. The one thing that I'm so worried about as I get older is that kids 3, 4, 5, 6 won't have the exposure that I had really early to classic film from the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Because
and,
it's so easy for parents to just show them Moana 4.
Yeah.
Not that I did see.
I won't be showing my kids Thor. The first thing I'm going to do is show all my kids. They're going to ask me why I liked Michael Jackson. I'm going to say, I like Michael Jackson because Michael Jackson liked this. And that's what I'm going to. And I'm going to show them why I love pop culture. Hopefully why pop culture made me have you and buy a house.
Well, the beautiful work that like Beyonce did with the videos that were homages to Michael Bennett and Fosse, like really was that they were such clear homages that you were able to say, hey, wait a second, watch this other video.
Sure.
And use Get Me Bodied
or All the Single Ladies. But people don't appreciate that shit now, and they need to, because we're about to go into a deep, dark era.
Or they do, and that's one of the weird things about something like La La Land trying to remake or recapture that same energy behind, a kind of behind the scenes Hollywood thing. I do have to say that Good Morning was one of my first American earworms. And I remember being a little kid in Hawaii, just newly moved from the Philippines, and Singing in the Rain was on TV. And I was just wandering around for weeks and weeks saying, good morning, good morning. And, it was, and I tried to reenact the Singing in the Rain dance, in the tropical jungles, right? But Debbie Reynolds was one of the first people who ushered me into and welcomed me into this pop culture landscape here.
Yeah.
Well, that's beautiful. Wow. On that note, let us bid a fond farewell to Carrie, George, Debbie, and all the fine artists we lost in 2016, and let's hope 2017 in so many ways is a kinder year. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell and Karen Toxin. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozymizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Anna Heathen and Vita Leon for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the very patient Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.